I will convene the Education Finance Committee today. Members, our first order of business is the approval of the minutes from March 19th. Representative Jordan, have you had a chance to look at the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I noticed that there is a spelling error on one of our testifiers. It should be Dr. Justin Killian, not Dr. Justine Killian.
Okay, perfect. We will.
And I believe there's another one as well. Dr. Bailey's name is also needs another E at the end, at the middle of Bailey.
Perfect. Thank you for your eagle eye on the minutes. With that, members, are there any other further question on the minutes?
Otherwise, Madam Chair, I move their approval.
Thank you. Representative Jordan moves the minutes. All those in favor say aye. With the correction,
aye.
Say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. The minutes are adopted. I'd just like to hit the gavel, that's all. With that, members, sorry, you got a little bit of a late start today. We will get going with our first bill on the agenda. We have House File 3803. Representative Norris, welcome back to the committee. Members, I will move House File 3803 before us as Representative Norris gets settled at the table. And now House File 3803 is before us. Go ahead, Representative Norris, and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Joaquim and members of the committee. It's great to be back before you. House File 3803 aims to create a state program that would provide stipends to our student teachers so that they can get paid for the time that they are working in the classroom as students. This is an issue that's been on my mind for a number of years in education policy. When we made the stop there, I talked about how this came to my attention a number of years ago, before I was even in the legislature. I was working on developing a new policy agenda for the organization I worked for, and we were trying to figure out what could we do to increase the number of teachers of color in Minnesota. And one of the things people told me was, well, you could pay our student teachers. And I said, what? And they said, yeah, student teachers don't typically get paid. And that was a real head-scratcher for me because they're doing work. It's hard work. And on top of that, they're also paying tuition while they're student teaching. And so it only makes sense to me that we make sure that these educators in training are getting paid for the, essentially the internship that they're conducting in the classroom. I think this would accomplish a number of things. It would overall increase the number of teachers that we have going into the profession. But in particular, it would help to address the disparities we see in terms of teachers from underrepresented backgrounds coming into our classrooms. I'm proud that this is a bipartisan bill. This is an issue that I know Representative Erdahl has been working on for a number of years. He's got a bill that he introduced along the same lines. Appreciate him signing on to my bill as well. We've got a number of great testifiers who can speak more specifically to the issue, including their own personal experiences. So with that, Chair Joaquim, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Norris. First up, we have Caitlin Efta. She's remote. Please, it looks like she's on there. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, sorry, just give me one moment here. I need to shut my classroom door. I'm currently student teaching and something's out in the hall.
Members, this is what I love about remote testimony. We get people in their real elements and all the work, wonderful work they're doing. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you. Chair Yuka, members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Efta. I am a senior here at UMD studying elementary and special education, and I am the statewide president for the Aspiring Educators, a union of more than 4,000 future teachers in Minnesota. I'm also a current student teacher. I'm on my lunch break at school right now. I wanted to thank you, Representative Norris and Chair Joaquim, for working with this bill to help pay student teachers. We've heard for years how hard it is to student teach and how hard the student teaching semester is from students and from teachers across the state. And not only do we pay tuition for a semester where we're not taking any classes and we're not even going to campus, but we're also serving a full-time job in the schools as another adult in the classroom. We help lesson plan, we grade papers, we're supporting students while collaborating with our mentor teachers. And if we can't afford to live, how can we afford to teach? I've heard from many students who have dropped out of their teacher prep programs because they just couldn't afford it. and programs where we're graduating with a Minnesota teaching license, it's really important to keep these programs strong because we are going to be your future. We're your future educators, and if we want to help stop this educator shortage, it starts with us, and it starts with helping us. On top of paying my tuition, many of us have to drive 20 to more than 40 minutes away for our placements, which we do not have a say in where we get placed. I have a friend who is currently at the Minneapolis schools at the University of Minnesota, and she has to drive 2 hours to her placement every day. So that's 4 hours of driving total just to teach in a classroom all day long. We get stretched really thin with how much experience we're getting in this classroom and how much work we're putting in, and it would only make sense to compensate us for all of the effort we are doing. This bill that we have would reduce financial barriers and go a long way to make preparation for teachers more affordable for aspiring educators. 9 out of 10 schools in Minnesota can't fill open or essential positions for teachers. Our enrollment for the biggest teacher prep program in the state are at half of what they were a decade ago. Where I can speak to my program specifically, our integrated elementary and special ed program at the University of Minnesota Duluth used to have 3 blocks each semester, so it'd be 3 cohorts of 30 plus students, and now we only have 1 cohort per semester, and it's about 20 students. So we've gone down by about 66% in enrollment. This bill would be a huge way for us to help the educator shortage and make a more serious effort towards educator recruitment. I want to thank you guys for your time, and please support this bill and help pay our student teachers.
Thank you, and thank you for being willing also to go into special ed, and good luck with your student teaching.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we have Laura Mogelson. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Laura Mogelson, and I'm here from the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Teacher Education. Chair Youakim, members of the House Education Committee, I'm here to express strong support for House File 3803. I'm going to give you all a little bit of background first about student teaching in Minnesota. Teacher candidates must complete a minimum of 12 weeks of full-time student teaching for an initial teaching license. For most teacher candidates, this is indeed an unpaid experience. Student teachers are both undergraduate and graduate students. So the student that we just heard from here is an undergraduate student. There are graduate students. Sometimes people are, in fact, not only doing full-time student teaching during that semester, but they're also taking coursework. So there are many different models out there. The person you just heard from there, she's a full-time student teacher. Sometimes people are also taking full-time courses on top of that, really making additional work to earn money impossible. Student teachers often come into the profession as career changers. We end up recruiting a lot of non-licensed school professionals with or without bachelor's degrees into our programs. These expectations of unpaid student teaching come from a time when we had predominantly full-time undergraduate students who were supported by their families. Unpaid internships were very common until somewhat recently, the past couple of decades, across all sorts of content areas. We now recognize in other fields that unpaid expectations do disadvantage students. So due to this recognition, unpaid internships are much less common now. Students report experiencing financial distress during student teaching. Many people often drop out of their programs because 3 months without an income is not a viable option for them. And then if they do decide to work while they're doing their full-time student teaching, that puts a lot of stress on them and affects their ability to do well in their student teaching. We do have some competitive grant programs out there available for student teachers to apply for prior to student teaching. They don't know, though, going into their student teaching often if they're going to be getting that funding. And so it comes as a, you know, a welcome surprise. It's also difficult in recruitment if we're thinking about recruiting someone into the field 2 years down the road, they may be student teaching, for us to not be able to talk about the support they would receive during this time. So we feel as the large body of colleges of teacher prep in Minnesota that this is a very important piece of the puzzle in addressing the teacher shortage in Minnesota. So thank you, Representative Norris, for your work in this bill and members of the committee for your attention on this matter.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, members, we had a few public members sign up for testimony. We have Dr. Elena Bailey, and then on deck we have Dontre Lofton. Go ahead and state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you. Chair Uakim, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Elena Bailey. I'm the Executive Director of the Professional Educator Licensing and Standards Board, otherwise known as PELSB. Thank you for the opportunity to support HF 3803. PELSB is responsible for establishing the state standards required to be a licensed teacher in Minnesota, and we also oversee the state's teacher preparation licensure programs. PELSB's mission is to ensure all Minnesota students have high-quality educators in their schools. As the agency responsible for overseeing teacher preparation in the state, we work closely with providers to ensure student teaching experiences prepare teacher candidates to work with all Minnesota students. Student teaching is an essential part of the teacher training process because it provides invaluable classroom experience, mentorship, and feedback to aspiring teachers. In Minnesota, student teaching is a minimum of 12 weeks and is often completed as an unpaid experience. While the benefits of high-quality student teaching preparation are well documented, we also know that the financial burden of working without pay is a deterrent to many. We appreciate the conversations taking place today to address the financial needs of our aspiring educators, including Representative Erdahl's bill, that proposed much-needed financial support. Additionally, HF 3803 ensures student teaching stipends do not reduce eligibility for other important financial supports. PELSB applauds these efforts to support our future educators, and thanks, Representative Norris, for carrying this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Bailey. Next up, we have Dontre Lofton. Go ahead and get settled and state your name for the record and proceed.
Hey, good morning, Chair Uakim and esteemed committee members. My name is Dontre Lofton. I am currently enrolled at MCTC, and I am a Black Mentee Student Fellow. I am eagerly preparing to transfer to Augsburg next fall to pursue my teaching degree in elementary education with a mathematics endorsement. Today, I stand before you to testify in staunch support of HF 3803, and I extend my sincere gratitude to Rep. Norris for championing this bill. As a non-traditional student, my journey towards becoming a teacher has been deeply influenced by pivotal moments in my life. The spark that ignited my passion for education was kindled back in 2014 with the birth of my son. Parenthood has a remarkable way of reshaping one's priority and aspirations, and it was in the profound moment of caring for my child and nurturing that I felt the calling to embark on this journey. Though my decision to pursue a career in education officially took shape in 2021, it roots trace back to that transformative moment 9 years ago. Since then, I have dedicated myself wholeheartedly to this purpose, to this pursuit propelled by the profound desire to positively impact the lives of future generations and contribute to the advancement of equitable education. One of the key provisions of HF 3803 that resonates deeply with me is this offering of financial support for student teachers. As a non-traditional student and a prospective educator, navigating the financial aspects of future of pursuing higher education while preparing for a career in teaching can be daunting. This bill's commitment to providing financial assistance to student teachers is not just a lifeline, it's a beacon of hope for individuals like myself who are dedicated to shaping the futures through education. The financial support offered by HF 3803 acknowledges the diverse circumstances of aspiring educators and help alleviate the financial burdens that can often hinder their progress. As a Black Mentee Student Fellow, I understand firsthand the importance of financial support in enabling individuals from underrepresented backgrounds to pursue careers in education. Too often, financial barriers prevent talented individuals from entering the teacher profession. In conclusion, I urge the committee to wholeheartedly support HF 3803 and its provision for financial support to student teachers. By investing in the success of aspiring educators, we not only empower individuals to fulfill their dreams of becoming teachers, but also strengthen our education system as a whole. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, and thank you for being willing to go into the profession of teaching, and especially elementary, and especially with a focus on math. I like that.
Thank you.
With that, members, we'll go to member questions. Representative Clardy.
Thank you, Rep. Norris, for bringing this forward. This is a very important bill. I have a lot of similarities to DeAndre. I was a career professional who decided to change careers. I already had my bachelor's degree. I owned a house. I had a child, you know, that whole thing. And the only way I could have done a career transfer would be to have a paid internship. And it also, you know, beside the obvious, it takes a lot of stress off. You don't have to do that extra job where you're working full time. So you're able to embrace your time or, you know, put your time and your balance into your career. So I strongly support this. I think it also will help diversify the teaching profession like you stated early on. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, any further? Representative Anderson.
Thank you. Just something that I brought up with a few of my colleagues, but I think over the next, you know, year or so, we should really start rethinking how this is done, because these students are also paying tuition to a university that has absolutely nothing to do with this except maybe helping place them. And that's very expensive. And that's not the norm, okay, in other fields. And this has just been, it's very, 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 very outdated what's going on here. But they could easily need so many, hours of internship, help it get coordinated by the school or wherever, or the department of ed or whatever. And it wouldn't even, it could be completely outside of their college. And it would just be a requirement for a teacher's license. So that would save a significant amount of money for these students and time. And I think because it's so difficult for, you know, students to get through this process, and it's not necessarily a career that is, you know, paying $100,000 a year, right, coming out of a chute, or ever probably, right? But we're just discouraging our young people and certainly our best and brightest from following this career path. And so just something for all of us to think about. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Members, any other questions or comments? Representative Perez Vega.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris. We've studied the research last session, this session, the proportion of students of color to teachers of color. These are the avenues and the steps for those teachers of color to take their first journey into those classrooms and feel validated. And as somebody that learned and connected with the student teachers more than my own teachers, because they understood the community, they helped with our grammatic errors when we have an advantage of knowing two languages or more instead of it looking as it was a disability. These are the connections that made in those efforts, and to see that they were, you know, they don't get valued for that time. Time is money, okay? And there's a lot of time that's invested by student teachers in our communities. And so I am so grateful that you've presented this bill today alongside the co-authors, and I look forward to supporting more of these initiatives. Thank you.
Thank you. Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Norris, for your bill. I'm going to come a little, I've been thinking about this for a long time, and I'm going to go down the vein of Representative Anderson's thoughts. I actually think that we agree on the problem, which is the undervalue of student teachers. And as I think about this in the business world and in many other ones with internships, this model doesn't exist because they've decided on a better model. One of the things perhaps we could think about is schools are crying for substitute teachers. So why not create a model where we already have money where we're paying substitute teachers? Why not take this out of the college, don't pay the tuition on your 12. And what you do instead is you go to a school district and you sign up and you get hired as a long-term sub. Let's say you're a math teacher and you're a mentor with the math department and you get multiple teachers to work with. They're going to pay you anyway for the long-term sub. And at the end of the year, the school district's going to decide whether they should hire you or not. It becomes a pipeline for teachers into the classroom. That's what we do with companies all the time. I bring in many, many interns. We hire them and we mold them and then they become great employees. So I think there's an opportunity to completely rethink this. We wouldn't even need the $18 million because it's already sitting in schools who are crying for substitute teachers. And a good teacher will learn and develop quickly with good mentors. So I think there's an opportunity to actually rethink this completely. And I actually, one of the things that you thought mentioned, Representative Anderson, is don't pay tuition. Get that out of there. Get that liability away from the students. Get them into the classroom. So good luck with your bill, but I think there's a huge opportunity to rethink this model.
Thank you, Representative Krusha. We talked a little bit about that in ed policy, too. One of the things I think folks worry about is having somebody teach in a classroom by themselves and have members that are also teaching. It's hard for that engagement to happen, but definitely a model that needs to be rethought. Representative Norris, final comments.
Thank you, Chair Youakim. You know, we've been fortunate to have some really powerful testimony today. Ms. Efta talked about how 9 out of 10 schools can't fill openings for teachers. Mr. Lofton talked about how he sees being an educator as a calling. When we have both this big need for educators as well as people who want to pursue what they've discerned as a calling for them, I think it's in the state's best interest to do everything we can to support them. And so I'm excited to bring this bill forward, and I look forward to the committee's hopeful support for it.
Thank you, Representative Norris. With that, we'll renew the motion to lay over House File 3803 for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. Next up, we've got Representative Erdahl, House File 3401, someone who has also worked long and hard on this issue as well. As you get settled, Representative Erdahl, Lead Krusha, would you like to move House File 3401 before the committee with the intention to lay over the bill for possible inclusion?
Do I have an opportunity to table it indefinitely? I will move the bill.
Thank you. Representative Erdahl, proceed.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here with you today. Thank Representative Norris for bringing up his bill on student teaching. And just would like to say I was a public school teacher for 35 years. And I student taught sometime in the last century. And so I know what this is about. And I appreciate the testifiers. Anyone who's wanting to testify to what I'm doing, fine, but I didn't request anyone because I thought I'd let Representative Norris do the work. And some of the points that I would make have been made. I may repeat a little bit, but some other things that I think are new I'll throw out here as well. First of all, we have to work together to get something done. And we have a shortage of teachers. I've done some things over the years to try to enhance our teaching cadre, master's degree for credit in your content area, doing more in mentorship to make sure that we don't continue to lose as many teachers in the first 5 years as we are doing now. But we still have a shortage. I recall, you know, my student teaching career was, you know, a great thing. But I found that I really didn't know as much as I thought I did when I hit the classroom. And so there are different models of student teaching that I've looked at over the years. I mean, I've had bills, several bills, regarding student teaching. I agree with the comments being made that, you know, maybe the direction we need to take is to have it tuition free. I mean, that's something I think we need to explore. I had a bill once for year-round student teaching. Frankly, as I said, I thought I knew everything when I came out of student teaching, that 12 weeks. and realized that had I had more time in student teaching, I would have been a better student teacher and a better teacher. Not that I didn't become a very good teacher, but, you know, in the beginning, it took me longer than I thought. And so I met with Posy Solberg, the architect of the Finnish education system, which is regarded by many as the best education system in the world. And I asked him, what is the key? And he said, teachers, teachers, teachers. He talked about the masters. Every one of their teachers has a master's in their content area, which is what prompted me to do what I did here in Minnesota. He also said that their student teachers all have a year-long course. And so I actually did manage to get a year-long pilot program passed in Minnesota, and St. Cloud State and St. Paul College each administered a year-round student teaching. They did not view it as a success, and the prime reason is that the students couldn't afford to do it. And so that led me more to the reason that we're here today. The comments have already been made how our student teachers are having to leave the college that they're in, leave their housing, maybe leave their job, often go to a town distant. You know, if I was in St. Cloud State, which is where I went, you know, maybe I'm sent to Benson, maybe I'm sent to Morris or somewhere. You can't bring your job with you, you can't bring your house with you. And so you are paying to work, and you've incurred more expenses than you had before. And that's one reason why we lose teachers, or we have those who do not go into teaching because of this problem. And we can address it. I don't know what the best way is, and we have stipends in Representative Norris's bill. I'm proposing grants. We could be proposing tuition free today. I really don't care that much which approach is taken, as long as we do something to address the problems that we are having in education with our student teaching and with our teaching shortage in general. Now, I just roughly figured out some numbers here. We have about, I believe, 3,000 student teachers in Minnesota each year. I mean, if we did $1,000 a teacher, that's $3 million. You know, you could go, if you give them $2,000, you're $6 million. If you give $3,000, you're $9 million. But that's something. You know, it's not $18 million. I know you're going to be looking at numbers here. But if you look at it minimally, even $1,000 is only $3 million. Mr. Strom, I'm right with my math, right? Okay. I was a history teacher. So I guess while I'm here, just a brief mention that another reason why we have a shortage of teachers is their pensions. I'm just going to let it lie at that. It'd be good if sometime we could take a closer look at that too, or you guys could. So anyway, I just want to emphasize again, you know, thank you for hearing this. Thank you for hearing, you know, Representative Norris's bill, and emphasize again, let's please try to do something. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. And your wisdom is always appreciated. And you're right, we need to do something. And thank you for mentioning pensions. With that, members, we'll go to comments from the table. We have one public testifier. I forgot. Laura Mogelson, come on down. Please state your name for the record again and proceed.
My name is Laura Mogelson, and I'm here from Minnesota Association of Colleges for Teacher Education. Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Chair Youakim and members of the House Education Finance Committee. I won't repeat myself from 10 minutes ago, but I do have some additional points to bring to the table with our support of Representative Erdahl's bill, House File 3401. We are supportive of expanded opportunities for funding student teaching that is a full year, as is outlined in this bill. This concept is actually already supported by current work already happening in teacher preparation around our work in year-long pre-service teacher residency programs. And so there are programs that are happening already in partnership between the Minneapolis Public Schools, the St. Paul Public Schools, the University of St. Thomas, University of Minnesota Twin Cities, others. There's a competitive grant program actually that's happening now as more partnerships between preparation programs and school districts are looking to build out this model of having a year-long student teaching residency. So we are very supportive of this. Year-long student teaching provides an extended period for student teachers to just really immerse themselves into the school, to build relationships with students, to be a co-teacher, and to gradually take on more and more responsibility over the year. So we really see the value in that. So an investment in this, or an expanded investment in this, would align to the work that's already happening around this residency model for pre-service teachers. I just want to clarify one thing from the teacher prep perspective about the idea of credits and paying for credits while you're a student teacher. Our Pelsby could speak to this too, and Dr. Bailey did talk about the fact that we have standards for licensure. There are the general pedagogical standards, and then there are the content-specific standards and the standards that are aligned to the teaching methodologies. Often these standards are tied to credits that are tied to student teaching, and people are earning credit for their degree and their teaching license concurrently. And so yes, these credits do cost money, but they are fulfilling standards that are required for the licensure, and they're earning credit for either their undergraduate degree or their graduate degree. So the credits are not worthless, I guess I would say. They're actually connected directly to the degree and to the license. So I think that's an important clarification. And there's a lot of work that we're doing also right now around the idea of apprenticeships, which is not a word that we've heard yet in this chamber. We've talked a lot about internships and unpaid internships, but there is a lot of work and action happening with the Federal Department of Labor and Industry around paid apprenticeships and the idea of earning job-embedded credit for degree and licensure. So I think that's an important thing to point out. So I would like to thank you all for listening, and thank you so much, Representative Erdahl, for not just your support of this year, but your longstanding support of our future teachers.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Members going to the table, Representative Lardy.
Thanks for bringing this bill. I think it's really great. I did a year-long internship, and I think it made a difference, partially because I was able to see how a classroom started and how it finished, and then also build and establish those relationships. It also prepared me for the unpredictable fire drills and that type of thing that you don't really focus on, or just how to problem solve at the right on spot. So I fully support having a year-long internship. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments or questions? Lucretia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just again, comments to support the bill. And I think the most important thing you said is we just need to do something. We need to start figuring out some solutions and figuring out what can work and what cannot. So thank you for that, Representative Erdahl, and thank you for your bill.
Thank you. With that, I'll renew the motion to have House File 3401 laid over for possible inclusion in the education finance bill. Next up, we have Vice Chair Clardy with House File 4615.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Paul. We can pull up a third chair up there, too, if you want. Thank you. Representative Vice Chair Clardy, welcome to your own committee. Would you like to move House File 4615 before the committee for possible inclusion in an education finance?
I would, yes.
Thank you.
So moved.
Representative Clardy's motion. We have House File 4615 before us, and proceed.
Okay, House File 4615, the purpose is to shed the light on the Minnesota principals and what they're seeing on the ground as far as what's actually going on. It will also gauge how legislation is working in the schools from experts on the ground, and its appropriation amount is $210,000 to help support the collection of data and disaggregation of the data as well. And the state partnership will also bring more attention to the survey to leverage greater participation. And I have some testifiers, Chair.
Great. I have first up, I have Patrice Relaford. And yeah, we don't have I was looking for that overhead, but we don't have one yet. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed. Sorry about that.
Thank you. My name is Patrice Relaford. I just want to thank you, Chair Joaquin, for allowing me to be here, and I want to thank the members of the committee for considering this bill. Again, my name is Patrice Relaford, and I'm the Vice President of Collective Impact and Giving at the Minneapolis Foundation. The Minneapolis Foundation is one of the oldest community foundations in the country. We partner with nonprofits and public sector organizations and facilitate grant making. We also support research and advocacy and assist individual and family philanthropists as they seek to make a difference in their communities. We wear a lot of hats at the foundation. Some days we convene people, some days we write a check for important causes, but most days we listen. We rarely own and lead a project by ourselves, and that's by design. Instead, we engage the community to learn from them about where resources should be directed and consider ways to elevate community voices. I'm here on behalf of the foundation to elevate the work of the University of Minnesota and the K-12 principals statewide by expressing our support of House File 4615, a state investment in elevating the voices of principals through the Minnesota Principal Survey. Our foundation, along with our partners at the Joyce Foundation, we've been honored to provide grant support for the survey since the beginning of the process to launch it in 2021. We stand on the shoulders of years and years of research, particularly by the Wallace Foundation, on the positive impact that principals can have on the students, teachers, and schools they support and lead. The University of Minnesota is a very key and critical partner for this work. The Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement combines world-class research expertise with practical on-the-ground knowledge and relationships with principals, superintendents, and others in our school, teachers as well. These people, particularly principals, superintendents, teachers, and school board members, trust the University of Minnesota and the Center to be an honest broker. And more than 30% of principals statewide responded to the survey in 2021, and that response rate increased in 2023. The Minneapolis Foundation continues to be committed to elevating the voices of our school leaders across the state. However, philanthropy is meant to be catalytic, and rather than investing in initiatives over time, we tend to, as our priorities change, we sometimes have to shift away from what we fund. But we support support House File 4615 because we want to ensure that the investment in principal voice is sustained long term, and the incredible findings coming out of the survey remain available to school districts, higher education institutions, schools, teachers, and you as policymakers. I must also note that the state already invests in a number of surveys, so most notably the Minnesota Student Survey, and then also the MinSpire Teacher Survey. So funding the Minnesota Principal Survey is a logical next step for our state. With that, we ask the committee again to support House File 4615 to continue to invest in our school communities and school leaders, and to hear directly from principals about how we can best support them and the work they do on behalf of our young people, teachers, and parents and families each day. Thank you again to the committee, and thank you so much to Representative Clardy for carrying this bill. We appreciate the time to speak today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vice President Relaford. Next up, we have Dr. Katie Patel. Go ahead, state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning. My name is Katie Patel, and I serve as the Executive Director of Educational Leadership at the University of Minnesota. Not entirely sure what that title always means, but in this case, it has me serving as the principal investigator in charge of this survey. Chair Joachim, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today to humbly share with you the sentiments of nearly 1,000 principals, assistant principals, and charter school district leaders from across the state as a result of their participation in the survey. I want to begin, though, by acknowledging the work that this committee and others did in the last session to improve education for so many in Minnesota. And I want to thank you for hearing our testimony today on House File 4615. In just a moment, I'll share with you five key takeaways from our research team's analysis of the data that includes responses to 130 closed-ended questions, six open-ended questions that produced nearly 200 pages of comments. The survey took respondents an average of 34 minutes to complete, which I think Representative Bakeberg can attest to. 34 minutes are not easy to come by for a principal to complete a survey. In just a few short weeks, a full report of the findings from the 23 survey will be available at our website, where our 2021 summary reports are housed. Data can also be accessed there via our data visualization platform, Tableau, which we find folks are using to answer their own questions about school principals increasingly. Before I share the highlights, though, from the survey, I'd like to take a moment to highlight the ways in which the first Minnesota Principal Survey conducted in 2021 has actually already impacted the field of education in Minnesota. It has influenced administrative licensure programs, of which I believe you may have received letters from Mankato State University, Hamline, and St. Thomas, and how they changed coursework and internship activities as a result of the survey. It has informed the work of our principals' associations. Presentations have been done at all of the educational leadership conferences and more, including 15 across the state. It has supported the University of Minnesota's research into understanding mental health needs across the state. It drove the development of a pilot project at the Minnesota Department of Education to help develop culturally responsive school leaders. And five policy and practice briefs were generated that summarized the survey, the focus group data, relevant literature, and made recommendations to policymakers, leaders, and prep and PD providers. With an even higher percent of response rate, as Patrice mentioned, 41% in 2023, we expect the survey to have an even larger impact than the 21 did. Now to the data. I want to begin with the voice of one of the respondents. Quote, "Being an instructional leader is what I want to do, and I'm prepared to do. Yet, our roles have largely become managerial. We do not have the support and or time to do what we should be doing. I wish that wasn't the case, but mental health needs, lack of staff, and initiative mandate overload have watered down the principalship from instructional leaders to building managers." This particular sentiment shared by a respondent could be a summary statement for much of the data that was gathered. Principals want to engage in those aspects of the job that they know will have the greatest impact on student learning, yet they're struggling to find the time and space to do so. The five key takeaways I will share with you today are, number one, a lack of time, number two, a loss of confidence, number three, challenges related to mental health, number four, concerns with capacity regarding legislation and lack of guidance, and finally, a dedication to the job. First, lack of time. Consistent with the 21 findings, principals told us that their job responsibilities far exceeded the time they have available to fulfill them, leading to stress, burnout, and in some cases, intentions to leave the profession. As a matter of fact, before I walked up here today, I got a text message from a superintendent saying, I have a principal that needs to leave for the rest of the year. Can you help me find one?
Dr. Pickell?
Yes.
We have only a few more minutes.
No problem.
Testimony on this, if you could.
I'd be happy to.
Thank you.
Yes. The second takeaway is a loss of confidence in their ability to carry out activities. We asked them 49 items about their confidence. In all except for one, their confidence level dropped from the 21 survey to the 23 survey. We also asked them, what is their greatest challenge? This will probably not come as a surprise to you. Their greatest challenge they identified was student mental health. Though you should know that almost all of the principals that responded, 94% of them said this was the number one challenge that they were facing right now. They also have concerns with capacity. Those would be resources, skills, and time to implement legislation, and they have a concern about a lack of guidance coming from the Department of Education. Finally, though, they do have a dedication to the job despite the challenges. And I'll share this one sentiment that a principal shared. They said, it's a really difficult job that I wouldn't trade for anything. So I'll end with this short thank you from the voice of a principal. Thank you for asking about our perspective. We want to do this work and do it well for students, families, and the staff we serve. However, education currently is, I don't know how to continue to retain high-quality individuals without some change. Thank you, Representative Clardy, for carrying this bill. And I will turn it back over.
Thank you, Dr. Pickell, and members. There's a lot of great data in the survey, and we put part of it in your packet for you to look at. I'm sorry to have to cut you short on this. We'll go to member questions. Representative Vernick.
I don't have a question, but I do want to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I did get the luxury. It's actually where I met Rep. Bakeberg for the first time to hear the survey. It's not the first time I've heard the survey results. I did hear the previous ones. And the thing that stood out to me was the 94% found mental health to be the single biggest challenge, yet only 45% felt sufficient or more than sufficient in handling mental health needs of students. And this work, I think, is invaluable, especially the voices of principals. So thank you for bringing it forward, Rep. Clardy.
Thank you. Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Clardy. I really appreciate you carrying this bill. This one touches home. This one touches home to me. The voice of the principal is critical. I would encourage you, members, to take this packet out from Carrie and actually read it and look at it. And I'm going to walk through it in a little bit. Before I do that, Dr. Pickell, can you please share either the 2021 results or the 2023 results? Where are the places that you've had the opportunity to share those results? You touched on it, but I want you to, can you just talk about where those results have been shared?
Dr.
Yes.
Pickell.
I'm sorry, do I need
to? Oh, you just have to go through the chair. Dr. Pickell.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Yes, they have been shared at the educational leadership conferences of the elementary school principals, secondary school principals, school superintendents association, school boards association, association of metropolitan school districts, the rural education association. They have been shared with the senior management team of the Minnesota Department of Education. They have been shared with every single administrative prep program provider in the state of Minnesota. That's 14 licensing institutions by institution. So, for example, if you are the overseer of the St. Thomas program, you got the data from folks who responded who went to St. Thomas only.
Representative Baker, follow up.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Pickell, for investing in principals. That's quite an exhaustive list. Have you one further question? In whether the House, the Senate, any level of state government, have you shared the results of these findings?
Dr. Pickell.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Not officially. I've sent them to you.
Seth Baker.
And actually, I've had informal conversations with other members on the committee. I apologize, but I don't want to call that out because that puts people on the spot.
Yep.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, and I just want to be very clear. I'm not on this bill, and there's really two reasons why. The first one is the 5% set aside for MDE. Like when I'm approached with a bill, one of the things that I do is say, yeah, that sounds like a great concept, but I need to read the bill and actually see what's in the bill before I sign my name to it. So when I read the bill, I saw that 5% set aside to the department, and I knew the excellent work that Dr. Prickell and her staff had done, and I really questioned why we needed to spend $10,000 to go to the department. The second thing, and it gets into the questions that I asked Dr. Prickell, we should have held hearings on this. It is completely unacceptable that we did not take time to hold hearings on a survey from 2001 and 2021 and 2023. It is unacceptable, and it was a choice that we did not. Chair Joachim, you and I talked about this as we were walking over, and you said, we just simply don't have time. That's unacceptable. Former Representative Dabney said we are data.
To me about this survey, I just wanted to correct that.
That's not true. I did.
You did not ask to have it heard, and if you did, I would have. So could you continue, please? Sorry that I interrupted you.
I'm not the bill author, so I appreciate hearing the bill, but you told me we did not have time to, and if I need to communicate with you an email moving forward so there's a record of that, I can certainly do that. But we had a conversation on the steps of the state office building, and you told me we do not have time to give Dr. Prickell a hearing to hear us. That is a fact. Going on, we had former Representative Dabney say, we are data rich and application poor. So I want to take a minute and walk through this, because Dr. Prickell wasn't given a chance. She was cut off to walk through things. So the READ Act, I would give Representative Edelson credit. She is working so hard on the READ Act and doing a wonderful job. She answered a text last night, I think it was about 9 o'clock. So thank you to her. Implementation and timelines, there are not enough funds. That's in the survey from principals. Non-exclusionary discipline. Principals seem to overwhelmingly be seeking guidance specifically from the department. Turn the page, K-3 suspensions. Principals acknowledge suspensions should be used sparingly, but feel frustrated this mandate does not acknowledge what some say is a rare tool. Recess detention. Respondents seem frustrated that legislators are predetermining what should or should not be available to principals in regard to discipline. Prone restraints and physical holds. Principal indicate a need for legislative language to be cleaned up. Thankfully, this is done. Pupil withdrawal agreements. There seems to be a lack of understanding and rationale for this policy. I'll stop there. And Dr. Prickell summarized it. There's a principles based off of not Ben Bakeberg's response. I am one of the respondents. Principals across Minnesota, 44%, 991 principals in Minnesota, to summarize, feel a lack of guidance, a lack of support, a lack of clarity, and a lack of feeling like they have a voice. And when we don't hold a hearing to give them a voice, that is unacceptable to me. And I would say we should hold a hearing on the student survey. We should hold a hearing on the Minspire survey so that people can tell what is really happening without fear of retribution. And I'll end with this, to quote Dr. Prickell, who quoted a principal, it's a difficult job, but I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Thank you, Representative Bakeberg. And yes, email probably is the best way if people are requesting hearings on something. That's usually our process. And we did ask Dr. Prickell if she wanted to present the full survey today. And that's why she said no. That's why we have the handout in the packet. More than happy to talk about it. There is a lot of great information in there, and I do appreciate it. And there is also a lot of great information on the student survey. And maybe we will have an informational hearing after this. I do want to point out during the COVID times, which we should have a nickname for that, we did have three whole hearings, hearing from every single person and adult that works in a classroom to see where people were, where they thought we should go in the fall, and to really get that data. So we love data here, happy to do that. And we'll go back to the focus of the bill, which is actually investing in collecting that data, which is, I think, important to pay people for the work that they do, and want to thank the Minneapolis Foundation and the Joyce Foundation for helping fund this so that we have this data before us today as well. Members, are there any other comments at the table? Lead Grisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Tardy, for bringing this, and thank you, Representative Bakeberg. I think I'll just bring it to this point. I think as long as I've served on this committee, one of the things that I'm constantly reminded is no matter where you serve in the school district, whether you're a custodian, a teacher, an administrator, a dean of students, a counselor, this is real. Mm-hmm. And the students are affected by that every day, and so are the adults. And I just, the comments I hear today are real. This is in front of us. And what this survey highlights is that voice and us needing to move forward and have these very, very difficult conversations. So thank you for that. Thank you, Representative Bakeberg, for your comments. And I hope that we can remember that this affects many of us in ways that we never really know. And the survey can bring out that voice, but there's a lot more behind it. So thank you for that, and thank you for having this bill.
Thank you, Representative Krusha. With that, I'll give Representative Clardy final comments.
Thank you. This was a great discussion, and the voice of the principals is really critical. And I think this tool will give us the data that we need to continue conversations. So thank you for hearing this, and let's go.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. With that, members, Representative Clardy renews her motion to lay over House File 4615 for possible inclusion in an education finance bill. Members, we'll move on to our next item on the agenda. We have House File 3595. Representative Sensenmura. Welcome to your committee, Representative Sensenmura. Would you like to move House File 3595 before the committee?
Yes, I would.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. I think what we're going to do is we're going to let you do your opening, and then we're going to go to Mr. Strom to kind of walk through one of the handouts that's in the packet. So, Representative Sensenmura.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee members. I think I want to start with just saying, you know, House File 3595, I think, is a start to a broader discussion that I look forward to having with members of the committee, advocates, stakeholders over the next few months. You know, I think one of the things that I have been struck by being a member of this committee is really the unique, I think, and more flexible than other states, open enrollment policy that we have here in Minnesota. And I've been attempting to kind of learn more about where that policy came from, why we have that policy, what are the benefits that that policy is bringing to our students and families and schools, and also what are some of the challenges that that is bringing. And so this bill kind of starts a conversation about addressing one of those challenges. And this is our special education funding system and our kind of billing system for that. So I think one of the more kind of opaque aspects of our special education funding system is special education tuition billing, and that's what this bill addresses. When a student open enrolls or attends a charter school, so that means they leave their resident district, the district where they live in, a portion of those costs of services is billed back to the student's resident school district. This bill would reduce the amount of unreimbursed special education costs billed back from 80%, which it currently is, to 50%. This bill ensures that charter schools that bill back these costs to resident districts would continue to receive the same amount of revenue, so charter schools would be kept whole, but instead of resident districts paying, it would be more state aid. And I think Mr. Strom has some runs that show the district to district that he will go over. I really care about this issue, and you will hear from testifiers today, including our new superintendent in Minneapolis, who I'm incredibly happy to have with us. You know, this is a really big issue for my district. In Minneapolis, tuition bills are increasing 8 to 10% each year. And we have to remember that with these are costs and services that resident districts like mine have no control over. It is simply deducted from the special education aid that we get as part of the special education funding formula. Underpinning this whole issue is kind of a historic idea, and this comes from kind of the start of our open enrollment laws that I think we should look at because I worry that some of them are outdated. It comes from this historic idea that a student is a resident of a district even if they have never attended school in that home district. As the state has added various choice options over the past few decades, fewer students are attending their resident district, which has increased the amount of tuition billing. So in Minneapolis, this results in Minneapolis being billed for students that have never set foot in a school in our district. There's also, you know, I think things that we need to look at in terms of resident districts that can, the problems that come when we have homeless shelters or juvenile facilities that fall in the boundaries of a resident district. This often means that districts become the resident district for students that attend these facilities that then go out of state. And so those districts are again, on the hook for students that have never, you know, stepped foot in a school building in their district. So I believe that all of these issues warrant us as policymakers to spend, you know, the next few months working with the Department of Education, stakeholders, and, you know, I would love to work with members of both caucuses to address these issues that are causing, you know, some really, really major challenges for our districts. And with that, I would love to turn it over to Mr. Strom to kind of help us walk through the runs for the district and to get a sense of really how is this playing out on the ground in each of our districts.
Thank you, Representative Moran. Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, there are three documents in your packet today to help with this issue. The first of those is the, pardon me, the fiscal note, which explains the potential impact of House File 3595. There's some good narrative in there as well as some information about the potential costs. The second document is the relatively long document that MDE puts together called the Cross Subsidy Report. This annual report highlights trends in special education funding, shows the difference between revenue and expenditures, and provides a great deal of detail about how those costs vary by individual districts. And the third document that we're going to spend just a minute on this morning is the district by district printout that's in all of your packets. And this printout lists for fiscal year 24 the estimated special education revenue amounts. And the columns for today's bill that I want you to focus on are the net tuition column, which is about halfway through the page, and the net tuition per pupil column. The way that the spreadsheet works, you can see in the first couple of columns there, there's the regular special education aid plus the excess cost aid, and those amounts are our initial front end of the special education formula. Then there are some adjustments for the homeless transportation and the hold harmless and the cross-subsidy reduction. All of those come into play in determining the special education amount, but this bill is focused on that column called net tuition. And if you look at the state total at the top, you can see statewide there's zero net impact to tuition. But this is not the case for all districts, and in fact, it's not the case for hardly any institution in the state. If you look at the strata at the top of the file, you'll see that all of the different regions of the state are essentially negative. That is, they receive more tuition bills than they have tuition bills going to others. And the two exceptions are the charter school line and the cooperative line. And you can see there for the charter schools, there's about $86 million of net tuition charged to school districts. And for the cooperative organizations, about $119 million charged to school districts. The way tuition billing works in Minnesota is the front end of the special education formula for each school district is calculated, and then for non-resident students, whether they're in a charter school, a cooperative, or served by another resident district, a portion of that amount is billed back to the resident district. That portion, in general, the special education formula can cover roughly about 60% of the costs. So in general, on average, about 40% is being billed back, but that's not the case uniformly and varies a great deal by the service levels that are provided for the students for whom tuition billing works. If you look to the second to last column, one of the issues that's hard sometimes to see in the totals is the impact by scale. And if you look on a per pupil basis, that helps scale the amounts, and you can see the relative impact on each of these districts. Since Superintendent Sales Adams is here today, Minneapolis School District we can look at as District 1. And you can see that for that district, about $30 million of their special education revenue is, their overall special education revenue is transferred to other school districts under the tuition billing. That's about $1,000 per pupil, and you can see that that amount dwarfs that of nearly every other school district in the state. As a result, this is one of the reasons that the tuition billing is such an important part of Minneapolis's budget discussions and its concerns about the way the special education formula works. The key to remember on tuition billing is the resident school district receives the bill but does not determine the level of service that the student receives. That level of service is decided by the serving institution, whether that's another school district or a charter school or a cooperative unit. So the net result for the resident districts under a tuition billing system is that they get a special education tuition billing amount that's not essentially of their making or their control. Madam Chair, that's a very quick overview of a very complicated subject, but I think your time's probably best spent hearing from the folks that are with you today.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. That really helps. And thank you so much for putting the spreadsheet together and going through it. I had looked at it last night and thought that's what that second to last column meant, but I'm glad to hear it from you so to make sure I'm reading it right.
Madam Chair.
Oh, we have some clarification questions, it looks like, from the table before we go on. Oh, a few. lots. All right, we have Greenman first, then we'll go to Jordan, then we'll go to Pryor, then we'll go to Cresha.
Thank you.
Oh, no, Jordan. Okay, Greenman. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Tim, for, as always, shedding light on a really complicated subject. I just have a question for clarity about these two, which is how does this interact with the per pupil funding, and where does that go, or is that not accounted for in this, the loss to the per pupil funding from the district that has the resident child?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Greenman, the general education funding for the child follows the funding to the served institution. So if a student open enrolls from Hopkins to Minneapolis, Minneapolis picks up the general education funding because that's all based on the number of kids served. So unlike the special ed area, there's a little interplay with general education billback for certain special education students. But in general, for a student that open enrolls into another district, that district simply counts that student for funding purposes. Our regular funding system, our foundation general education program, it's called that. That system is all based on students served. And so there's not a tuition billing outside of special education for those students.
Thank you. Representative Greenman, quick follow-up.
Yep. Okay. So am I right to understand that if a student leaves the district, that the district both loses that per pupil funding and is on the hook for these costs?
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, the Representative Greenman, in Minnesota, the funding is based on a per pupil count. So I wouldn't necessarily refer to it as the district losing that funding. Whether the student attends a charter school or another resident district or a non-public school or is homeschooled, they're simply not counted in the students served for the regular funding. So I know in some contexts it's helpful to think about, well, gee, what if all the residents in a particular district attended that school? But the money really in Minnesota for outside of special education just simply goes on a per pupil basis to the district providing the instruction for that student.
Thank you. Representative Pryor.
Oh, thank you. Sorry. I guess I was thinking of the same, along that same line and trying to understand it. And then what caught my eye is the districts that I represent, which is Hopkins, Eden Prairie, and Minnetonka. And Hopkins and Eden Prairie are the negative, and then Minnetonka actually is substantially positive. And it seems to be tied back to this idea of open enrollment and how money is counted per pupil, but then also is specifically following a special education, or that there's billing back based on that particular student that might be open enrolling to another school.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Pryor, yes, for resident districts, the bill back is for any of those three reasons. And so for a district like Minnetonka that open enrolls a great number of students from the nearby districts, if Minnetonka provides special education to those open enrolled students, whatever portion is not funded through the special education formula is billed back to the resident district. So let's say that there are 1,000 open enrolled children in Minnetonka and 15% of those are special education students. For that 150 students, their special education costs that are not fully funded by the front end of the special ed formula are billed back to the resident districts where those students are from.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Along that line, before I go to lead, Krisha, too, Mr. Strom, am I right in assuming that, you know, we had a cross subsidy in special education to begin with because the formula wasn't covering the cost for anybody, but we did tackle 50%, almost 50% of that last year. Did that help alleviate some of the bill backs, do you think, Mr. Strom?
Madam Chair, that helps the resident district cover a significant portion of those expenses. That cross subsidy aid went from roughly 6% being phased into a 50% level. So nearly half of those costs now on the delay, on the 1 year lag, will be picked up through the cross subsidy amount. Yes.
Mr. Strom, would that end up having to helping with the bill backs a little or not? Because the charter school or whoever's serving that student could bill back the differential to begin with. So they didn't really have a cross subsidy. So I'm just trying to make that connection a little bit in my head, Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, members, if you look at the cross subsidy column, which is the fifth column in there, you'll see for the co-ops and the charter schools in the strata that they have zero there. There's essentially not a funding element for that, not a state aid element, because for co-ops and charter schools, that amount is billed back to the resident district. So the resident district is now considerably better off because of the increase in special education cross-subsidy aid, but they're still paying essentially 50% of that bill back is going to be uncovered by the resident district even after the cross-subsidy goes to 50%.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. Lead Krisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to mention that as well. I mean, let's not forget the fact that the cross-subsidy was a very positive thing. And so I want to call that out. Mr. Strom, if you could, as I'm reading through part of the research here, the long-term fiscal considerations and the local fiscal impact. As I've read through these a couple times, I'm sensing there's more behind, there's some red flags or some warnings at least being raised. That, I mean, a couple of them talking about taking spots from their own districts and how you plan from this. I wonder if you could just give us a little bit more clarification on what the thought was as you put those together.
Mr. Strom.
Madam Chair, Representative Krisha, yes, the fiscal note's invaluable about thinking about the big picture issue that Representative Sensimura raised, which is Minnesota's system of open enrollment, school choice, and the issues about behavioral reactions to that. So, for example, if it becomes much cheaper, or I shouldn't say cheaper, much more cost revenue efficient for a district to provide its own program or to send a child to a facility that's like one run by a cooperative institution, behavioral changes can occur. So, for example, if a resident district were to find that serving a child in its own district is less cost efficient, there are rules regarding special education students being in the least restrictive environment possible. But I think there are any adjustments to the formula, there are concerns that behavioral changes will occur, and maybe a school district will say it makes more sense for us to offer additional programming through our cooperative organizations or less, depending on where the state incentives are. In my view, and again, I apologize for the time, Madam Chair. In my view, these are real issues, but they're a bit at the periphery when one thinks about the $2.4 billion of special education funding that we have currently. If 10 or 20 or 30 million dollars is shifting, that's a big number for all those involved, but a relatively small percentage. But they are real issues. And I would encourage the committee to think about those when they think about the structure of both special education funding and the role Minnesota assigns for the resident districts.
Representative Kreisha, follow up.
All I just want to say is thank you for that. And you mentioned the behavioral changes that I have seen and witnessed firsthand, how some school districts can have to take on students for this, and it becomes a very difficult situation if they're not prepared for it. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Representative Kreisha. And I have one other technical question. You know, this is clearly a bigger discussion that we can have here in committee today, and I'm glad you brought it forward so we can start this discussion. I had gone to a national conference and had a chance to talk to some folks that do the federal special education program, and they had brought up a question, and I'm not sure if we have it in statute or if it's common practice or not, but does the resident district get to participate in the IEP process of wherever that child's going, since they're the ones that are paying the bill? Mr. Strong?
Madam Chair, Representative, or I'm sorry, Madam Chair, the answer's no. There are, around the periphery, there's some language in the statute about that the school district can essentially pay attention to what's going on with the IEP, but the resident district does not have a say in denying the IEP or setting the IEP or otherwise able to influence how that IEP is established for the students that are resident of that district but being served by a different school district.
Thank you, Mr. Strom. That is what raised some questions from the woman I was speaking to. So something to think about this summer as well. With that, I think I'm thank you, members, for raising your hands for questions. We've been talking about this issue and looking at it for a while, so I kind of forget that sometimes other folks, this might be your first experience with it, so I do really appreciate you asking questions. It's kind of like when I talk to my husband, sometimes I start the conversation in my head, and then it comes out halfway through. So thank you so much. With that, we'll go to our first testifier, which is Josh Downham. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Madam Chair, members, Josh Downham with the Minneapolis Schools. And I just want to say thank you, Madam Chair. In the past, you've been a great advocate on this issue to help kind of bring this issue into the light. This is one of those issues that's really deep in the weeds. As Mr. Strom very well articulated, the special education formula is very complex. And this is one component of a very complex formula, but has real implications for many districts across the state. And I love the fact that at the Capitol you can have a day on the Hill for homeless day on the Hill or EMS day on the Hill. I would love someday to have special ed tuition billing day on the Hill. I don't think we'll ever get there, but it has those statewide impacts. And I think Representative Kreisha brought up an important point. You can have a small district that has a few students that become residents of that district, and it can blow that district's budget. In our case, in Minneapolis, we have a number of homeless shelters. We have students become residents of Minneapolis when they are in that shelter. If they're being served in a high need setting, or in some cases served out of state, we see bills in the hundreds of thousands of dollars. We need to take a look at what residency actually means in the age of students that are mobile and school choice. Residency was important back in 1985 when I was at Washburn, but those laws have changed, and I think we need to revisit the idea that underpins tuition billing, which is residency, and look forward to working with members of both caucuses. Appreciate the conversations we've had with the Charter Schools Association and the department. But I think you probably want to hear from person on my
left. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Downham. And we're going to have to keep it tight for testifiers, but 2 minutes each. We do have one other bill to go to after this, and this is clearly a discussion we'll be having, a bigger discussion we'll be having over the interim as well. We will be going to 12:15 just to get to Representative Hewitt's bill. So with that, Dr. Lisa Sales-Adams, Superintendent, Minneapolis Schools, welcome to the Education Finance Committee, and please proceed. State your name for the record, and please proceed.
Lisa Sales-Adams, Superintendent of Minneapolis Public Schools, seventh week on the job. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for hearing my testimony this morning. I wanted to thank Representative Censormuro, for presenting House File 3595. This is a very important topic in our district. As Representative Censormuro mentioned in her opening remarks, special education tuition billing can have and does have significant impacts on the district's budgets. Because resident districts do not receive state aid or local levies for students who open, enroll, or attend charter schools, the cost of tuition billings come directly out of the funding we need to serve students in our own schools. And these costs are completely out of control of resident districts. Tuition bills are submitted to the state and deducted from resident district special education revenue. As you know, Madam Chair, some of the tuition bills from charter schools exceed $45,000 per pupil. Last year, Minneapolis Public Schools was billed $28 million, and this year its totals are up to $30.4 million, which is an 8% increase. Next year, the increase is projected to increase by 9.5%. Minneapolis Public Schools is dealing with the loss of federal pandemic aid, significant increases in transportation costs, in addition to this nearly 19% increase in special education tuition billing in just 2 years. I'll leave you with the story of one mom who literally broke down in tears recounting how her son's autism needs required the support she found in a specialty charter school. The cost of those services were coming at the expense of students in the school that her son just left. She simply asked, why? Why are we pitting families against each other? Madam Chair, if the state values the school choice system we currently have in place, I would encourage the committee, and actually encourage the committee to address inequities it creates for many of our districts. Representative Censormiro's bill will help districts across the state facing these rapidly rising costs by reducing the amount billed back to resident districts. Thank you again for the opportunity to testify, and thank you for bringing this bill in front of us.
Thank you, Dr. Sales Adam. Next up, we have Tony Bowden, Director SPED at Robbinsdale Schools. Please get settled and state your name for the record, and then after that, we have a few members of the public that have signed up, so be on deck for that.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Tony Boyden. I'm the Director of Special Education for Robbinsdale Area Schools, and this is Ann Gruey, the Assistant Director. Thank you, Representative Censormiro, for authoring the bill. I would like to share three key points about special education tuition billing and how it impacts Robbinsdale Area Schools. Robbinsdale Area Schools paid $3 million for students who open enrolled or attended charter schools in the 22-23 school year, which comes from our current funding that we use to serve our current students, which continues to decrease as our enrollment decreases. The challenge of tuition billing is that Minnesota allows families to have school choice. However, the resident district has to cover the costs for these students who attend another school. The resident district does not receive any revenue for these students, therefore limiting funds for current enrollment. Robbinsdale recently announced that we are facing a budget reduction of up to $17 million for the upcoming year. And lastly, resident districts do not have any input in programming for students who attend charter schools. However, resident districts are responsible to pay the tuition bills, which I can say with confidence increase yearly. I appreciate the committee tackling such a complex issue. We want to ensure that we meet the needs of every student in our district, and I appreciate your work to help us accomplish that. Thank you for the opportunity to hear and share our experience at Robbinsdale.
Thank you so much for being so concise. With that, we have three public testifiers. If you all want to kind of come down, one's virtual, but the other two, if you want to come down and get settled, I think we will go to the virtual testimony first. Tom Kearney, Director of New Heights School. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for the opportunity to speak today. Good morning, almost noon. My name is Thomas Kearney. I'm the Executive Director of New Heights School, which is a longstanding charter school located in Stillwater, Minnesota. For the record, I'm also a licensed social studies teacher, K-12 principal, and superintendent. I've been at New Heights School for 29 years and served as its leader for 28 years, and I've seen many changes to how schools are funded, including changes to the tuition billing system on more than one occasion. New Heights was among the very first schools chartered in the state of Minnesota more than 30 years ago. New Heights opened in September of 93, not knowing exactly who or how many students would enroll, or what the needs of that school's mystery population would be. I came to New Heights in 95 in the school's third year. The school at that time was still establishing itself and was still working to define its true role within the community. We've evolved into a school that now serves a special needs population of over 50% at this time, which means that my school is dependent on the concept of tuition billing and recovering funds for special education services. If reductions to the funding system were to occur, charter schools like New Heights would suffer, as would its students. This year, we have tuition agreements with seven independent school districts, some of which frequently refer some special needs students to programs like mine. New Heights does not recruit students, special needs or not. These students simply felt at one time or another that they needed a change and found what they felt they were looking for within some of these charters. The fact that we have a higher than average special education population enrolled at the school speaks to the importance of various sources of funding that schools like New Heights rely on. We need more special education funding, not less, in order to offer an appropriate level of service to our students, and we simply can't afford to lose or see any reductions to any source of funding, including that which could be related to this bill, if any reductions were to even be considered. So with respect to HF 3595, I appreciate that it does distinguish differences between districts and charters. I'd simply ask that the committee strive to ensure that charters are given full consideration for an equitable level of funding as compared to our resident district cohorts, primarily because there is no difference between the students who attend public charters versus those who attend.
Director Kearney, we've had the 2 minutes. Can you please wrap it up?
I'm wrapping it up. My hope is that charters are considered as an equal entity invested partner in the state's public education system, and that one day funding disparities between districts and charters will completely be eliminated. In this case, I hope no reductions will occur. Again, I hope you consider my testimony today. That you contemplate this, whatever this final form the bill is going to look like, will take an equitable approach to districts and charters. I sincerely appreciate all the things you legislators have to do for considering topics like this. I know it's not easy. I hope and appreciate that HF 3595 will not and does not propose to reduce in any way vital funding special education.
Thank you, Director Kearney. Just a reminder to folks, wrapping them up does not mean saying your same comments faster. So next up, we have Dr. Susan Outlaw, Executive Director of MetroTEF. Thank you. Please state your name for the record. Proceed.
Excuse me. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this time to share about MetroTEF School and House File 3595. My name is Dr. Susan Outlaw, and I'm the Executive Director at MetroTEF School. We opened our doors in 1993. We're one of the oldest charter schools in the country, yay, Minnesota, and we are the oldest deaf-blind, and hard-of-hearing charter school. We have over 35% of our students are BIPOC, but one of the important things is for you to know that we serve over 43 different school districts. Over 70% of our students are placed by those school districts. Mm-hmm. So when Chair Joachim asked about being involved in IEP, every resident district comes to the IEP of all of our students. They have a say, they are part of the educational team, not just for the initial when they're enrolling in MetroTEF School, but all the way through their career. They come every year to evals, to IEPs, and that's a really important distinction. We actually don't recruit kids. We have calls and emails daily from resident school districts all around, often with newcomers who have never been to school before and who are deaf and 12 years old. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have all of those, and so we work in partnership with resident districts. This issue is a problem, and it's a problem that wasn't created by special ed students. It's a problem that wasn't created by charter schools or by resident districts. It's actually federal mandates that are unfunded. And so I want us to kind of remember that and not to vilify the students that need those special services, because we do want to work as a partner with districts. You might be asking, because why would the district place at MetroTEF School? Districts commonly tell us we are a cost savings to them, because we are less than the cost of one sign language interpreter. When you look at the most recent Minnesota Registry Interpreters for the Deaf, the salaries are going to be between $50,000 and $65,000. What we are billing back is significantly, we're right less than that. That doesn't include benefits. That doesn't include PERA. That doesn't include any other services that child would receive. So they do see us as cost effective. And that's from Malacca, that's from Hinckley, that's from Shakopee. I mean, we really cover the metro and even outside.
Thank you, Dr. Outlaw. Could you wrap it up, please?
Yes. I just want to say thank you for being creative and how you're looking at this problem and how we can solve that problem together, that it's not a he or she or them or us, but that we work together to help our special ed students. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for all you do for our kiddos. Last up, we have Dr. Erin Lavery, Executive Director of Indigo Education.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dr. Erin Lavery, and I'm the Executive Director at Indigo Education, which is a nonprofit agency in Minnesota. I also serve as a Director of Special Education. Indigo Education is a nonprofit organization, and we've been in existence for 25 years in the state of Minnesota. Currently, my team members and I serve about 70 of the 180 charter schools that are functioning in Minnesota. Collectively, we have about 200 years of experience in and expertise in special education and programming for students therein. As leaders in the space, it's our goal to keep charter culture and innovation while simultaneously working within education law and executing our responsibilities like those individuals who serve as directors of special education in traditional public school districts. Again, charter schools are first and foremost public schools, and as such, we welcome all students who enroll. We believe strongly in parent choice and the provision of school choice for students with disabilities. My team and I support charter schools as they develop quality special education programs and for a wide range of students with disabilities, including students with vision needs, hearing impairments, who need behavioral support and assistance in meeting their goals in the areas of the academics. As you're aware, charter schools function as traditional schools in many ways. That being said, unlike traditional public schools, charter schools do not establish a district of residence, thereby making tuition billing imperative for our operation and our sustained functioning. It should be noted that most students who enroll in charter schools already have IEPs, and a program of service is already outlined for them in those documents. And to speak to the knowledge of the IEP and the resident district knowledge about that, the IEPs are sent on an annual basis to the district of residence, and so each district has a full knowledge of services that are provided within charter schools. Furthermore, charter schools do not receive the same funding as public schools, as we cannot levy for costs to help with our programming for students with and without disabilities. I'd like to reiterate that—
Dr. Lavery, could you please wrap it up?
Yep. For the charter community, it's critical to cover the cost of special education. By covering the cost at 90% and above, we can continue to program for our students who walk through our doors. Any changes in this formula must be done with the utmost care and delicacy because of its significant impact. The litigation costs alone, coupled with us charter schools not implementing FAPE and IDEA, could close some charter schools. So I just ask that the group really consider the details of the bill, and we work in collaboration with our neighbors who exist in the public school.
Thank you, Dr. Lavery. Members, we're going to go to the table for questions. Well, Representative West.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Lavery kind of touched on what I wanted to bring up, and it's that we don't want to solve this problem on the backs of charter schools, and not that this bill does, but we want to make sure that anything looking at the split, charter schools can't levy for costs, they don't get safe schools funding, so they're always getting shortchanged when it comes to funding compared to normal public schools. So we have to be very careful when we're tinkering with this. But I do have a question. I'm not just here pontificating. For any of the testifiers from these schools, do you have any specific examples that they mentioned there's reasons that, a variety of reasons that parents send their kids to a charter school for these services? I think it would benefit the committee to hear a specific example if one can be shared. I know we're tight for time.
Thank you, Representative West. I think we might have to move questions on. We're concentrating on the bill, which actually backfills that with aid from the state. It does not take any money away from charter schools. So maybe that conversation could be brought offline. Is there any specific questions about the bill in front of us? Remember, members, this is being laid over We are not going to be touching on doing this year. This was to start a conversation for the summer or for the interim. So any specific questions about the bill? Representative West?
Well, I would argue that that does directly determine the cost depending on the kids sent. So figuring out the reasons is very relevant to the bill. But it's your committee.
Thank you, Representative West. Yes, it is. Representative Sensenmura, wrap it up, please.
Yeah, thank you so much, committee members. As I said, you know, this is the start of a discussion that I really hope to engage with folks on both sides of the aisle on. This bill is not about vilifying any students or any schools, but it is about making sure, you know, to quote my superintendent who is here, that we're not pitting families against each other, pitting schools against each other, pitting students against each other. So looking forward to continued conversation. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sensenmura. With that, House File... House File 3595 will be laid over. Representative Hewitt, sorry for the quick turnaround. We do have another bill. Maybe members forgot. I know people have other places to go. But Representative Hewitt.
I was going to say, am I not up?
You are up, Representative Hewitt. I will move House File 4008 before the committee with the intention of laying over the bill for possible inclusion in the Education Finance Bill. You also have an A2 amendment. I will move that before the committee. Briefly describe the A2 amendment.
I have to look for it myself. My other people aren't here. I believe, where's my guy? Did we leave?
Mr. Strom, can you explain the H2 amendment? No problems. I think it's
technical. Thank you, Mr. Strom.
Thank you,
Madam Ms. Perez, sorry.
Madam Chair and members, the A2 amendment makes two primary changes on page one. The plan would have to identify not the staff that are there during the school day as well as after school when extracurricular activities are being conducted. And the second change is the plan would have to integrate an emergency action plan that was developed by healthcare personnel.
Thank you, Ms. Parra. With that, members, any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of the A2 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. The A2 amendment is adopted. Representative Hewitt, with your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll go quick. I'm sorry, I wasn't prepared for the amendment. What this basically does, everybody should know what an AED is at this point. What this basically says to our districts is to develop a plan to the use of that AED and where the AEDs are placed so everybody in the school knows what they are. What we're seeing across the state, not just in schools, but everybody knows where the AED is maybe or seen these AEDs but are afraid to pull them or use them when they need it, are needed. I do have testifiers here if you want to listen to this. Basically, it's in your committee because there will be a fiscal note.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt. I think we have time for at least two testifiers. If they make it quick, we will go with Paul Wirtz from the State Government Relations and then Dale Wakasugi from... another organization. So if you can both sit down and just state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. You came and members of the House Education Finance Committee. I'm Paul Wirtz, State Government Relations Director for the American Heart Association. I appreciate the opportunity to testify on House File 4008, legislation that will require school districts and charter schools to develop a cardiac emergency response plan, also known as CERPS. Cardiac arrest is the leading cause of sudden death in young athletes and most commonly occurs during or just after physical exertion while engaged in practice sessions, organized competition, other sports activities. But it also doesn't occur just on the sports playing field. It could happen in the cafeteria or as, you know, any type of school function. The American Heart Association is working to turn bystanders into lifesavers, so that in the time of a cardiac emergency, anyone, anywhere is prepared and empowered to become a vital link in the chain of survival and provide CPR. That means ensuring that every school and athletic event and facility has a CERP in place and is working directly with local emergency service providers to integrate this CERP into the community's EMS responder protocols. I'm going to cut my comments short in the interest of time. Chair Joachim, I want to yield the balance to my colleague, Mr. Dale Wakasugi, who really has a real-life story about surviving this. Thank you for the opportunity and appreciate your support of this bill.
Thank you, and he does. We heard it in Ed Policy. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the Minnesota Education Finance Committee. My name is Dale Wakasugi, a heart attack and cardiac arrest survivor, resident of Woodbury. a community advocate on behalf of the American Heart Association and owner of My AED and CPR Solutions. I'm pleased to be here today to offer my support for House File 4008, legislation that would require school districts and charter schools to create cardiac emergency response plans. I suffered a heart attack in 1986 when I was 36 years old. I was a very active non-drinker, non-smoker who played college baseball. In 2007, while refereeing a high school basketball game in Fridley, I suffered a cardiac arrest. One of my heroes that day was Lindsay Paradise, an 11th grader, who knew how to perform CPR and use an AED from learning about it in health class just a few weeks prior to that night. When cardiac arrest occurs outside of the hospital, survival more than doubles when people nearby act by dialing 911, starting CPR, and using a publicly available AED compared to waiting for emergency responders to arrive. I support House File 4008 because we need to ensure that all schools have cardiac emergency response plans in place and practiced so anyone who suffers a cardiac arrest, whether it be a student, teacher, school administrator, or member of the community, can receive the life-saving treatment they need. So I want to thank Representative Hewitt for authorizing this important legislation. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for your consideration of this bill.
Thank you so much for sharing your story, and thank you for being here with us. Members, we will go to the table for questions. Representative Vernig and then Lead Kreisha. Representative Vernig.
I just have one comment. I do have a bunch of questions, but I know in the interest of time, I will reach out to you, Representative Hewitt, to get those answered. I just want to go on the record for saying that it asks for one-time expenses, but this is there's an ongoing funding need to maintain AEDs, including replacement of pads, and I would just like to see more than just one-time funding for this.
Thank you, Representative Vernig. Lead Kreisha.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Representative Hewitt, I think this is a good bill, and I know that it comes from a place of passion as well, and to the testifiers, thank you. I would just add to this, I have a good friend who survived this, and I think this is very important. And perhaps if MDE is listening now, they could start sending out emails now encouraging schools to start doing this already without you having to put it into law. So good luck with your bill.
Thank you so much, Lead Kreisha. With that, Representative Hewitt, wrap it up, please.
Thank you. Thanks, everybody, for your continued support to possibly include this in your bill. Since this gentleman had his heart attack on the floor, it's the first thing I ask when I walk on a basketball floor, where is the AED? My age is getting up there, and so that's kind of where we're at. So thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members.
Thank you, Representative Hewitt, for bringing this bill before us. And with that, I will lay over House File 4008 as amended for possible inclusion. Members, next week, we're adjourning. Look at your calendars for next week. We're meeting Tuesday and Wednesday. The bills will be posted soon. We're adjourned.